Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 2:04 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is March 31st. I apologize for the late recording. I spent a lot of time today looking at investment trusts, and I'm posting a rather detailed Excel sheet in Comment of the Day today with a lot of data on how long a number of these trusts have gone without cutting their dividend. And I think that's something that's worth considering, because when we look at, for example, the FTSE 100, AstraZeneca, HSBC, GlaxoSmithKline, BP, British American Tobacco, these are all companies that have that are paying dividends, and the yield on the index is rather impressive. It's right around, I think, well, in fact, if we think about it in this way, how many more indices can you find that have a yield of over 6%? Well, of course, there are also some significant energy weightings in there, but the reality is that not every company is going to cut its dividend. More to the point, even if they were to halve their dividends, the yield on the index would still be 3%, and the yield on UK gilts is quite a bit less than that. And of course, that's for the 10-year gilt. When we think about the yield that is available right now, 35 basis points, that's rather incredible. But when we then think about what are we seeing right across the curve, well, it's a very flat curve, and the yield on the 2-year is 10 basis points. The yield on the 50-year is 60 basis points. So these are rather extraordinary levels, and in the UK at least, yields are still positive. When we look at the yields that we have right now on shorter dated US bonds, then they still go out to 1.3% on the 30-year, but the reality is that at 24 basis points you're not getting much for a 2-year. And when you look at 3 months, then there's been a very significant compression. This also, I think, helps to ram home the point that we have seen a remarkable compression in yields over the course of the last month. And on the last day of the month, the yield did rise somewhat, but it had spent most of the last week in negative territory. I think that's rather important to highlight, because when we look at, for example, the TED spread, then that is the difference between the LIBOR rate and the 3-month treasury. But of course, because the 3-month treasury has compressed so quickly, then it has sent the spread up to levels we haven't seen in a pretty considerable period of time. In fact, we have to go all the way back to the credit crisis to see anything that approaches these kinds of spreads between LIBOR and the treasury, treasury bills. When we then think about the LIBOR, well, LIBOR is obviously the an indication of what banks are, or what rate banks are willing to lend to one another. It compressed in early March, but it has done nothing but start a rise over the course of the last while. So LIBOR has been rising at exactly the same time that Treasury bill yields have been compressing, so that is creating this tightness in the credit markets. And so far, that hasn't really been ameliorated yet by the massive quantity of money that is being printed. When we look at the LIBOR OIS spread, then we're presented with a rather similar condition. We've had this really quite abrupt advance, and it's almost exactly the same thing. So the difference between LIBOR and the swap rate is almost nothing. So there is certainly a tightness in the financial sector. That is weighing on sentiment, and it is certainly going to, eventually, it's going to impair the ability of banks to continue to lend. Banks are in a rather tight position, because all of their biggest customers are now looking for additional funding. And despite the fact that central banks are printing and regulations are easing and reserve requirements, for example, in the USA have gone to zero, they're still in the position that they need to hold on to some money. They can't just make it all available because the rates at which they're making loans today are so low. That's part of the reason why LIBOR hasn't compressed. Not only do banks not know what the credit quality is of the loans that they're making to their customers, they don't know the credit quality of other banks either. And that kind of uncertainty is not something that's about to be corrected in the short term, because there is so much uncertainty around the unemployment situation and the wider economy. So certainly we can look at, for example, the yields that have accrued now following what is essentially an almost halving of some of the mid-cap indices. Now, the FTSE 250 was at 22,000 not so long ago and came all the way down to 12,000 and change. That was a decline of about 44%. When we then think about the Russell 2000 in the USA, it's also had this very considerable pullback. The problem is it looks like a type 3 top formation, or at least a type 2 top formation with the massive reaction against the prevailing trend in 2018, period of right-hand extension, and then the subsequent breakdown, which is an additional massive reaction against the prevailing trend. So the other, I think, important characteristic here is that a number of these mid-cap sectors have not bounced back in nearly as dynamic a fashion as some of the other markets. And the second section index in Japan is also looking quite weak. And that has historically been a very reliable lead indicator for the wider market. When we then think about the Australian mid-cap sector, arguably that is also much more oriented towards the domestic economy. It was at 7,500 and change at the beginning of the year and pulled back to 5,000. And so far, the rebound has been really quite mild. And that is against a background where, for example, the NASDAQ, with its overweighting of large caps, pulled back less and has also not rebounded in a particularly dynamic manner. The most important consideration right now is that the S&P 500, is right in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. It's the first area of potential resistance. So we did see a little bit of pause in here today, certainly not in a dynamic fashion, and it is the last day of the quarter. So having had a reasonable rebound over the course of the last 8 or 9 sessions, it's probably an ideal time for people to look at rebalancing and selling some of the weaker constituents and buying some of those that are potentially going to represent relative strength in the coming quarter. The second quarter of this year is likely to deliver some really quite disastrous looking employment numbers, growth numbers, and that is obviously going to weigh on sentiment. The much bigger question is, how long are the lockdowns likely to last? It is, I think, likely at least that we're going to see the peak in the infection rate for the USA at some point in April. We've already seen the peak in the infection rate in Italy. It's potentially now also arriving in Spain. Potentially we will see a peak in the infection growth rate start to come through in the UK within the next couple of weeks. I think it's likely after that we'll see the peak in the USA. The problem, of course, is that this is now a global phenomenon, and the pace with which it has been spreading in, for example, South America has been somewhat slower, but it's it's unlikely to be arrested by the warm weather phenomenon. Also, the fact is that we are now entering the winter period for the southern hemisphere, and therefore, even if it were arrested by warmer weather, it's likely to flare up in colder weather. So that is obviously something that is going to weigh on the Australian economy if we do continue to see the breakout continue to progress there. Now, one thing that I thought was particularly interesting in here today is copper prices. Despite the fact that stock markets were weaker in here today, copper was up by about 6 cents, and it continues to firm from around the $2 area. Orange juice is not an especially liquid market, and I certainly don't want to. That's an unintentional pun, but it has rallied very impressively over the course of the last 8 or 9 sessions, and not least because supermarket shelves are getting cleaned out. So that is certainly looking at the potential that there's going to be a shortage of some basic commodities. Rough rice has broken out of its base formation, and it continues to hold the move to new 5-year highs. I continue to think that wheat prices are likely to rally from here, for the simple reason that the winter crop was devastated by flooding earlier on this year, and that is potentially now being reflected in wheat prices, with the clear potential that housing starts are going to fall off a cliff. We're now starting to see that lumber prices have broken on the downside. So when we start to look around, there is evidence of some tightness in parts of the commodity markets and not in other parts. Of course, the big commodities are oil and gold, and oil prices are still weak. President Trump and Vladimir Putin had a meeting, and they both agreed that the price at the current level is in nobody's interests, but there doesn't seem to be any real intention to reach an agreement. And from Russia's perspective, agreeing with Saudi Arabia to limit supply is really only going to help US producers. They're unlikely to sign up to any real agreement until some of the USA's supply has been taken out of the market, but that's a private sector, not a national sector, so it's going to be difficult to enforce a national moratorium on energy production in the USA. That is just not how the US market is structured. Therefore, prices are going to have to stay lower for longer in order to knock out some of that supply forcibly. Of course, that is going to weigh on a number of the energy producers, but perhaps less so the larger ones. They are better capitalized and in a better position to ride out this period of low pricing, and not least particularly for Royal Dutch Shell and Exxon, because they have got a much greater focus on long-term agreements, and particularly with contracted values. There is also, of course, the fact that their yields are at rather extraordinary levels, and a number of these companies have got long histories of sustaining those dividends. Now, of course, by concentrating on my commentary on looking at some of these companies with these long histories of dividend growth and sustainability, that is to both highlight the fact that they represent a port in a storm. They also represent the potential for dividend growth later as economies progress. It's also that because of the big sell-offs, we've seen a significant ramp-up in their respective yields. But that, of course, is against the background where some of those dividends are obviously going to come under a great deal of stress. And there are obviously going to be parts of the market where there are going to be significant dividend cuts. So, for example, Carnival Cruises has already cut its dividend by 22%, but considering the size of the pullback in the share, I think it is reasonable to expect that they're going to cut their dividend again. There are a number of energy companies that are going to be under really quite extraordinary duress as a result of the massive decline we've had in energy prices. So it is reasonable to anticipate that some are going to have to cut their dividends. But I thought there was a graphic I posted last week, which I thought was really very instructive, and it's that even during the credit crisis, there were only six companies in the S&P 500 that eliminated their dividend. Of course, the other point that is worth reminding ourselves of is that the buyback often goes before the dividend, and companies will hold on to paying dividends long after they have abandoned their dividend buy or their share buyback programs. Now, when and of course that is one of the biggest negatives for the wider market, because buybacks have been the biggest source of new demand for equities over the course of the last decade. There are going to be a significant number of companies that are no longer able to buy back their shares. They'll be hoarding cash, and that represents the withdrawal of a significant source of demand from the market. Gold prices were in negative territory in here today, pulling back below the $1,600 area. I think there's potential this is a bit of a delayed reaction to the news that Russia is no longer buying gold, but it's also the last day of the quarter. I think we're going to get a better idea tomorrow of what investors are really thinking, with a lot of book squaring going on to round out a really disastrous quarter for a lot of portfolios. Then there is a clear incentive to try and get the losses done now so that they can then move on to look at better opportunities in the next quarter. It is worth reminding ourselves that there are shares that have been rising. Tesla is, in many respects, the barometer of global liquidity, and it has rebounded by about 25% off the lows. Of course, it has an ongoing demand for additional liquidity, and when liquidity conditions tighten, it doesn't tend to do as well. When they start to become easier again, then that is positive for the share. It's a quite a similar situation for Netflix. Of course, the challenge for Netflix right now is that it's not so much about the surge in demand for streaming services, but rather that we're in the middle of pilot season and there is no recording going on right now. That's going to hit into the number of shows that are going to be appearing in the next couple of quarters. This is usually the time when they start getting filmed, and that is just not happening right now. So there is going to be a lot of stale content on streaming services and on television generally over the next few months. Now, when we then think about the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index, it has been a really quite impressive lead indicator for the wider market over the course of the last decade, and it has not quite yet been able to push back above its 200-day moving average. Considering the size of the pullback and the fact that it bounced from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, I think it is quite likely we're going to get ranging. In fact, it is almost the base case that following a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, that we do get ranging. And that suggests that despite the fact that a significant number of commentators are looking for another V-shaped recovery similar to what we had in 2019, I think that is quite unlikely. Now, for the simple reason that back then we didn't have a global recession, and this time we do. And that is likely to contribute to a great deal of back and forth trading. So this is, if I think, when we look at the fact that there is value in the market, particularly among dividend paying stocks, also among those that offer clear leverage to remote working, the ability to work remotely via the cloud, these sorts of newer technology ways of engaging with the economy, those are likely to benefit. But the loss of consumers is obviously going to weigh on the market. The health of the US consumer was one of the great animating forces behind the bull market. And now, not just US consumers, but consumers just about everywhere have had to almost forcibly stop spending. And at the very minimum, that is reducing the velocity of money. So I think the reality is that we are seeing massive quantities of money getting thrown at the market, completely unprecedented. And it's unlikely to have an inflationary impact in the short term, for the very simple reason that you can't have inflation without the velocity of money picking up. And until we start to see economic activity starting to pick back up, then this is going to remain a rather deflationary environment. So there will be better potential entry points for markets. I think this is not a time where we have to panic into any kind of investment. There are going to be better opportunities to get in, that it is much more of now a buy weakness environment rather than chase strength. But we're going to see over the course of the next couple of days just what the likelihood is of a retest of the lows. Now, when we think about what's going on in China, then some of the hard data, like the number of journeys on the subway systems of Shanghai, Beijing, and Guangzhou, they have recovered somewhat, but they are still less than 50% of where they were ahead of the lockdowns. So even though they are trying to reopen the economy, consumers are rather gun-shy, and nobody wants to get locked up again for a couple of weeks. So there is obviously a clear reticence to engage again in economic activity. The stock market, however, continues to be supported by the government, and there is a clear incentive for the government to try to continue to support the banking sector and the extension of credit to the wider market. The Indian market has locked down the entire economy. So the Nifty index was in positive territory today, but I think it is very unlikely we're going to get a recovery until after India's lockdown has ended and we see just how well they've been able to contain the outbreak. If they can successfully contain the outbreak by locking down for the better part of a month, then that really would be the best case scenario. The one, I think, important point is that the range of potential solutions is increasing by the day. And that, I think, does give us a source for hope, because it is reducing the potential that we're going to get a second wave. And I think that is by far the most important consideration, because markets are priced on the assumption that we're going to have multiple quarters of negative growth. And we may not have multiple quarters. We may just have a very sharp but short recession, rather than a sharp and prolonged recession. The fear is, of course, that the other shoe is going to drop, that we're going to have another decline similar in size and magnitude to the one we've already sustained. I do think that that is unlikely, that at the minimum, we're going to see a loss of downward momentum. Eventually, we're going to get a massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend, and there will be a rally that is faster and goes further than we've seen in a while. I don't think this is it. The move that we've seen just yet is enough. And there is the clear potential that we're going to see a differentiation between various sectors emerging. And I think it is arguable that that has already begun, particularly with biotechnology, which did not pull back as much, but it does represent some of the solutions to the problems that are outstanding. When we then think about the commodity complex, well, the simple fact is that there's no need to worry about deficits in the short term, but we're definitely going to have to worry about deficits in the medium term. The effect of continuing to print money is cumulative on the loss of purchasing power from currencies. So when we think about the outlook for various currencies, the Chinese renminbi continues to remain weak around the 7 level. The pound, as very much a financial currency, has rebounded and is back and is unwound more than half of its decline. It is looking increasingly like a failed downside break below 120. Europe needs a weaker currency, and so does the USA now. So we've had a great deal of volatility in terms of the euro and the dollar, but Europe is not printing nearly as much money as the USA is, and that would suggest that there is room here for the euro to continue to strengthen against the US dollar. With commodities still weak, but copper starting to steady, then that should offer some assistance to commodity-related currencies like the Australian dollar, and that is up now to approximately 61.5 cents. The New Zealand dollar had also pulled back very sharply, but has rebounded and is likely to continue to do better from here. But when we think about the outlook for some of the more emerging market commodity currencies, then it's less likely to offer some respite, and the Brazilian real continues to trend downwards. The South African rand is also at all-time lows. I'm not quite sure whether that is an all-time low, but it is certainly a low that we haven't seen in an awfully long time. In fact, I remember first time I went to South Africa in 2001, I was getting 17 rand to the pound. It was probably one of the best holidays I've ever had, because I couldn't spend my money. And that was a rather, it feels like a long time ago now. And today, prices, the rand is significantly weaker than it was even back then. So this is going to create value in some of these emerging markets eventually. But it is, or I guess international investors are not going to be in any great hurry to rush back into emerging markets until we start to see some support coming through in their currencies. And that's all against a background where the dollar is weak. If the dollar had been firm, then these currencies would be declining very much more. So then if we go back and think about, well, gold prices have pulled back in here, but the much bigger picture is that currencies generally are weakening, because the clear solution that is being proposed by the majority of central banks is to devalue their currencies. And gold is the barometer against which all other currencies are measured. There is obviously some back and forth in terms of the trading from day to day, but the longer term reality is that it is trading in a medium term bull market, and that we're likely to see continued upside. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.